It's Nightlife.
If you're thinking about putting your money in a term deposit, what do you make of the prediction that if you invest money today and leave it there for 30 years, you'll end up losing money once you take inflation into account? That doesn't sound particularly attractive, but just one of the predictions made by the respected London Business School, and their predictions for other investment options aren't a lot better. There seems to be a growing acceptance among financial boffins that we've entered an era of low investment returns, and tonight we're going to have a look at what the future holds if you're an investor, and whether the bright spots are, assuming that there are still to be found, still out there. Fund manager and stock advisor Roger Montgomery joins us from Montgomery Fund. Good to see you.
Thank you, Tony. Delighted to be here.
Thanks, Roger. How spot on do you think the London Business School is?
Well, they're coming late to the party. Uh-huh. The PIMCO, the largest bond fund in the world, they've been talking about the new normal now since the GFC, and the new normal being this era of low returns across the world.
Yeah.
And the reason for it is really simple. You imagine if you've got a mountain of debt and you're buried under that mountain of debt. Well, quite simply, it's going to take years and years before you feel confident and comfortable going out and spending money again until you've paid off that debt. Mm. And that feeling that you have personally in your finances, not you, Tony, of course, but people generally, the same occurs for businesses, the same occurs for state governments, the same occurs for federal governments and entire continents. And that's what we're seeing in Europe and the United States and Japan. And it will take many, many years for them to get out of that burden of debt and to start creating enough growth and enough opportunities for people to want to spend money. And that translates to low returns for investment securities.
Mm. Quantitative easing has been happening a lot of countries, the United States for one and Japan for two. This is, for those who don't know, pumping money into the economy in order to try and get a result. To be honest, the Japanese economy has almost slowed to a walk, and that's probably been the case since the 90s.
That's right. It's been about 20 years.
It is very difficult, and they've got to do something desperately to get it.
Well, they've doubled their money supply over in Japan. But what's happening in the United States, and let's just talk about quantitative easing for those people who don't understand what it is. Essentially, what's happening is it's the printing of money in order to buy bonds. And to buy the bond, you buy bonds from a government, and that puts funds or cash into the economy. The only problem that we've seen, particularly in the United States, is that that money has gone straight to the banks, but the banks have been unwilling to lend it on. And so you don't have what's called the credit creation process. That's not occurring. And because that's not occurring, we're not seeing any growth. And what everyone was worried about up until very, very recently was hyperinflation. They were worried that because all this money's being pumped in to economies around the world, that you'll end up with massive inflation, the likes of which Germany saw in the 1930s and 1940s.
Where you had to have a wheelbarrow full of money to get
a loaf of bread. Exactly. Yeah. And they're worried about that. But the problem is this. The United States foreign reserves, their reserves amount to about 10 or 15% of the global reserves. China amounts to about 45%. So you could have quantitative easing for infinity in the United States, and it still wouldn't do much compared to the rest of the world. What really matters, and particularly to Australia, is what's going on in China. But this era of low returns is something that we're going to see for a long time. And I see it as a real opportunity rather than as something to be worried about and fearful about. There's opportunities to do very, very well in that environment.
The Australian dollar has been a little bit strange. Everyone keeps saying, well, it is very strong, and it's largely because of this quantitative easing elsewhere.
Elsewhere in the world, that's right. We've got more attractive interest rates as a result.
And the carry trade apparently has been very strong. In other words, people in Japan, rather than accepting the 0.1 of 1% interest, will send the money to Australia, invested here for 5% and be much happier.
Now, what's supposed to happen, of course, is the currency is supposed to offset that. You know, the difference in the currencies is supposed to result in that not being able to make money in the long run. That's arbitraged away. But it's not happening at the moment. And Australia's enjoying a very rare opportunity that people should be using to take advantage of overseas travel or buying properties in France and Spain and all those sorts of things, because you very rarely in your lifetime get this alignment of dust where you've got, you know, Europe in a recession, you've got property prices plunging over there at the very same time that their currency is weak and ours is very strong. But very few people are taking advantage of that opportunity, and they think that the Aussie dollar will be high for a very long time. And it won't last forever. We're a commodity currency, and eventually, just as commodity prices go down, so too will our Australian dollar. And that'll be a big problem for us. What's supporting our dollar at the moment is foreign investment, particularly from China. And that foreign investment into our resource sector is supporting our balance of payments current account deficit. Now, this is all very high finance stuff, but what it basically means is that China's foreign exchange reserves are starting to slow down, their growth in those reserves are starting to slow down. And if that continues, then what we'll find is that their ability to support foreign countries by buying their bonds and investing in those countries, there won't be any appetite to do that from them. And that means that their foreign flows, their cash flows into Australia will come out. And unfortunately, those foreign flows, we need that to support the deficit in our balance of payments. And we have a deficit because the value of what we export is not as high as the value of what we import. And so we've got to borrow money from overseas effectively or attract overseas investment to support that difference. And there's all sorts of reasons why. You know, I've had breakfast with Andrew Robb last year, and you know, he said to me, this is structural. You know, the current account deficit, Roger, is structural, meaning we can't do anything about it. And what he's effectively saying is we won't do anything about it, and our the value of our imports will always be higher than the value of our exports. But I ask you, Tony, why don't we add value to our exports? Why do we just send the dirt overseas and not do something with it? And if we did, we wouldn't need to worry about attracting foreign income and foreign funds and sell our properties and our farms and our businesses to overseas investors in order to support our profligate ways. We need to do a lot more. We need to do a lot more with our exports, but that's by the by. The Aussie dollar won't stay high forever.
Yes. What's your feeling? A couple of years or...
Look, I'm not one to predict, and I don't make the returns that I make from predicting where currencies or markets are going to go. And what I think is we're going to have low returns, and that means for Australia, mean reverting returns. That means we'll have a period of very high returns, and that'll be offset down the track by a period of very low returns or even negative returns. But it'll take 10 or 15 years before the world gets its head above the parapet again and feels confident to move forward. And in the interim, we'll have, as I say, some periods of very high growth between now and potentially 2016, and then it'll be offset again as people worry about something new that comes out of left field.
You have to say that when you look at the Australian dollar compared to the Japanese yen, I don't think it's been as high since... Oh, you know, the 80s, I don't think.
Well, now's the time to book your skiing trip to to Japan for Christmas.
Likewise, very strong against the British pound and also the euro as well.
Yeah, and the Aussie dollar is going to be very strong for as long as the iron ore price stays up. But I reckon the crack that is going to result in the house falling over will be the iron ore price. That's the thing to watch. And as that iron ore price drops, then everyone will become convinced that the boom is over, particularly in resource expenditure and capital expenditure in the resource and materials sector, and that foreign flow that's been supporting that sector, that will cease as well. And then we're in all sorts of bother, because what we'll have is we'll have the need to attract foreign inflows, but there's no appetite from overseas for those foreign inflows. So we'll need higher interest rates at precisely the time the economy might be slowing down.
This was called the Dutch disease, wasn't it?
It was, I believe. That's exactly right. And it's not the first time, and it won't be the last.
Indeed, indeed. Now, we've been suggesting that we're likely to see fairly low returns over the next little period.
Academics talk about something called the equity risk premium, and it's really, really, really a waste of time for most investors. And I mean that quite seriously.
Yeah.
Now, I think it was Einstein who said not everything that can be counted should be counted, or not everything that should be counted counts. And this is an example of that. So what academics do is they go away and they do some studies. They do a number of different research studies, and there's a number of ways of measuring the equity risk premium. But essentially what the equity risk premium is the extra return that investors want or hope or expect to get from investing in shares over a risk-free asset or a low-risk asset like a government bond.
Yes.
Now, let's
and the stock market has been all over the place over the last
exactly.
3 to 5 years.
Let me make the first point. A lot of people think government bonds are low risk. Given the returns that they're generating at the moment, we're talking about 2 and 3% returns, they are, as you pointed out in your introduction, guaranteed to produce a return that after inflation is negative. In other words, if you put your money away for 10 years in a bond that gives you 3%, then after inflation, you will have less purchasing power in 10 years' time than you have today. What could be more risky than being guaranteed to lose purchasing power? So everyone thinks bonds are low risk, but that's by the by.
The difficulty, I guess, for a lot of people is, you know, particularly as you enter the retirement years, you don't particularly want to lose sleep at night worrying whether the stock market's going to hold up or not. And yet we have to provide potentially, I guess, for 20, 30, 40 years of life.
And that's where I think a lot of financial planners are giving arguably incorrect advice to people who are retiring. Because if you're retiring, as you rightly point out today, if you're retiring at 65 today, then you're going to live on average about another 20 years. And some people, many, and that means that's the average, by the way. So half the population will live longer than that. And how are you going to fund your retirement if you're putting your money into low return debentures or term deposits or cash or bonds? So you have to be invested in shares. But how do you go about doing that in a low return environment? Well, the first thing is not to worry about what the academics say. So the academics are going to tell you that returns are going to be low. Look at the equity risk premium. And they're always going to come up with a low return. And the reason they're going to come up with a low return in their academic studies is because what they tend to believe is that the market is right. They believe that the stock market is always right and the price that it is today correctly values all the income streams from all the stocks out to infinity. And that is precisely wrong, by the way. Then what they do to that number, they then add a dividend component. And what they say is that, well, we can't have dividends or earnings growing faster than the economy in general or faster than GDP over the very long term that they're calculating these studies. And so they come up with necessarily a very low number. But I can tell you now, we've generated very high returns in a very short space of time, despite what all the academics are saying about low return environment. And the key is not to worry about the stock market overall. Mm-hmm. The key is to look at individual businesses and to not think about the stock market as a place to buy stocks that go up, but to think of the stock market as a place to buy pieces of outstanding Australian companies. And there are some, and they're not the usual names.
I have to say that is kind of similar to the Warren Buffett approach, where, you know, he buys companies like Gillette because he uses the blades, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, look, there are businesses that are generating growth in their earnings of 20, 30, 40%. We'll name some names tonight, but I'm not suggesting people rush out and buy these names, of course. One, because I may own them, and two, you may still lose money. So you need to go and get personal professional advice. But you want to buy businesses that have bright prospects for their products. You want to buy businesses that have little or no debt. You want to buy businesses that can generate very high rates of return on their capital. And you want to buy businesses that have the most important and valuable competitive advantage, and that is the ability to raise prices for their products. So Tiffany's is an example. It's an American business, admittedly, but Tiffany's is an example. There's no shortage, Tony, of diamonds in the world. There is no the supply is controlled, but there's no shortage of the product.
But the cachet.
But and Tiffany's can charge even more than the guy across the road. And people will, here's the interesting thing, people will pay more for a Tiffany's diamond, even though they know that the guy on this side of the road sells exactly the same stone of exactly the same quality. They'll pay more because of the cachet and the brand and because there was a song sung about it and a movie made about it. And you know what? When you get down on one knee and you propose to your future spouse to get married, you're not going to say, "Will you marry me? And by the way, I saved 20%. You know, that's just not going to work. And so they know that, and they can charge more for the product. And that's really valuable. So if you can find Australian businesses that have the ability to charge more, that have no requirement for debt because they have bright prospects and their intrinsic value is growing every year, and you can put a portfolio of those sorts of businesses together, then you will do better than the market, because the rest of the market is invested, quite frankly, Tony, in rubbish businesses. The index that everyone talks about is invested in big businesses that are mature, but they're not necessarily good businesses. And they haven't added value to their shareholders over the last decade. Take National Australia Bank, for example. National Australia Bank's share price today is less than where it was 10 years ago, and so is its value. Take Qantas, exactly the same thing. Virgin since 2003, exactly the same thing. Boral, Leighton's, Lendlease, big companies, Trans-Pacific Industries, big companies, and these are the typical names that are put in people's portfolios and they haven't grown their intrinsic value.
It's really interesting, Roger. You look at blue chip stocks from probably 30 years ago, and it's a very different list today, the top 10.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, a lot of the ones that were considered to be roll gold at that point
don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Well, let me, if I can take 2 or 3 minutes to explain how to look at a business,
yeah,
it'll give everyone an understanding. I want you to imagine for a moment that you and I have been given an information memorandum and somebody's going to run the business, and they've said, right, Tony and Roger, we want you to put some money into this thing and we'll run it for the next 10 years. And we won't say what the name of the business is just yet. We'll reveal that at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the amount of money they need to kick off, it's 2003. The amount of money they need to kick off is $184 million.
Okay.
So we put this money in. This is our money, Tony, from our bank account. And we've got permission from our families. And they've said, yep, no problem. So we've written out the checks for $184 million. Now, that's not quite enough. We also need some money from the bank. We'll need another $139 million from the bank.
Mm-hmm.
So we've borrowed $139 million from the bank. We've put in $184 million of our own money. And the manager of that business runs it for a year. At the end of that year, they come back and report to us, and we sit them down. We're all very serious.
How's that $300 million gone?
Correct. Well, ours was $184, remember?
Mm.
And they say, well, you've done pretty well. We've made $110 million profit on the $184 million that you put in, Tony and Rog.
Mm.
And so that's not bad. That's about a 60% return on our money. So we're thinking, we're delighted with that, because we can't get it in a bank. We can't get it anywhere else. There's not many other businesses that will generate that for us. So we let this particular individual manage the business for another decade. Fast forward to 2012. We've owned this business for 10 years. We call him back into the office and we say, all right, give us the wrap up. How are we going? And he says, well, remembering 10 years ago, $110 million profit, and inflation means we'd want to see that increase, by the way.
Mm.
He reports to us a $43 million profit, and it's been declining over that 10 years. So the profits are now much lower than they were 10 years ago. They're less than half of what they were 10 years ago. I don't know what you think, Tony, but I'd sack him straight away. And not only that, he says, oh, look, it's a little bit worse than that, by the way. Remember that $184 million you've put in?
Yeah.
You've now committed $929 million. So we've now tipped in almost $1 billion of our money.
Whoa.
Okay. So on top of the $184, we've actually put in another $560 or $570 million we've written checks.
We're in trouble, Roger.
Yes. And we've also we've reinvested the profits of the business over that time, about $120 million as well. So all in, we're now all in for about $929 million, and we're only earning $43 million. Not only that, remember we borrowed $139 million 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Well, we now owe the banks $1.7 billion.
I'm ringing Gina Reinhardt for a loan.
Right. So this is an unmitigated disaster in anyone's book.
Yeah.
Now, all I've done is quoted you the numbers from the annual reports from 2003 and 2012 of Virgin Blue or Virgin Australia Holdings. That's the airline. Now, you can look at any business this way. You can look at Qantas, you can look at Boral, you can look at the banks, you can look at them all the same way, and you can decide whether or not you would be prepared to own the whole business. And if you're not prepared, as Warren Buffett said, if you're not prepared to own the whole business for 10 years, don't own a little piece of it for 10 minutes. In other words, don't buy a share of it. And what will we do is avoid those sorts of businesses. And I reckon you can't help but beat the market over the very long run if you just remove those businesses from your portfolio and only own the really good ones.
I suppose when you think about it, publicity is a very big factor in a lot of this. In fact, as you were speaking, I was thinking about Enron in the United States. Sure. And they used to, they built themselves up into, I think, the fifth biggest stock on the US
yes,
market.
Yes, they did.
And they had nothing.
No, that's right.
It was house of cards.
They were counting. What they were actually doing was they were counting the face value of the futures contracts that they were trading as revenue. And what was interesting was at the time they got away with it, you know, and it wasn't until one of the fund managers, I think it was Jim Chanos, mm-hmm. who runs one of the largest short funds in the world, actually pointed out this was going on and shorted the stock. And that's right. And then it all went pear-shaped. But in Australia, we're not talking about those sorts of potentially fraudulent activities. Mm. We're talking about businesses that are just going about their business, but producing very, very low returns on their capital. And what you need to do is just focus on the businesses that generate very high returns on their capital. Because if you've got a business, think about it this way, Tony. I've got a bank account with $10 million in it, okay? And that $10 million, the government is, for whatever reason, they've said, Roger, we really like you, and we're going to give you this special bank account that earns 20% per annum. 20%. Now, that would be a very, very attractive rate. Okay, now what if I put that $10 million account up for auction? Let's say I auction that off to the highest bidder. Well, if someone wanted a 10% return on their money, then they know that that account's throwing out $2 million a year. 10% on your $2 million, that's about $20 million. So that $10 million of equity in the account, I could sell that for $20 million today, right? Now, my job is to find those $20 million accounts and buy them for $10 million. You know, I want to find the things that are worth $20 million and pay $10 million for them. And I can find plenty of businesses in the Australian market that meet that criteria. Unfortunately, right now, they're all really expensive again. The market's gone up a lot, and so they've all become quite expensive. And all I have to do, though, is be patient and wait for those really good businesses to become cheap again. And you think that it's not going to happen. You know, it's really hard to be patient and wait.
It's a bit like the real estate market. Everybody thinks that, house prices keep going up and up and up and up. At times they don't.
And that's right. And if you see in Australia, and it's true the rest of the world, the fear of missing out is far greater than the fear of loss. And so people will continue to chase good companies, even at very high prices, because they worry they're going to miss out on future gains. And once they throw the value of the business out and its income, the present value of its income, or even the enjoyment of its use, once they throw that out the window and all they think about is the gain that they're going to make next week or next month, then that's when you know we're at the peak of the market and the market's going to crash again.
We're talking to Roger Montgomery of Montgomery Fund. I'm wondering whether you'd like to join us. Maybe you have some thoughts on this that you'd like to put forward. Perhaps you have a theory on a company or two that has done the goods for you, or perhaps some thoughts about market strategy that you would like to investigate, or perhaps get some ideas on how to actually survive this era of low returns. If you'd like to talk to us, we'd love to talk to you.
It's nightlife.
In case you want to know, the Australian population is now 23 million and 30. We hit 23 million about 40 minutes ago. It is 19 minutes to the latest ABC News. You're listening to The Nightlife with Tony Dolroy. Roger Montgomery is with us tonight from the Montgomery Fund. We're looking for investing in a low return environment. Peter, you want a word. You wanted to ask about prospects for Telstra, particularly post-September.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. Roger, I actually saw you on the on Tiki Fullerton show earlier tonight, and I've been thinking you're taking some profits out of some of the Telstra shares because I'm obviously well ahead of the purchase price, but I'm just wondering what your view is if the coalition gets in, and of course they will be renegotiating some aspects of Telstra, whether it would be better to sell now or hang on and just see what happens after the election.
Well, I'm going to disappoint you, and I won't give you any advice on precisely what to do, but let's take a step back. Here's an interesting fact. Telstra's profits, by all the analysts, it's one of the most widely covered stocks by the professional and analyst community. All the analysts are saying that Telstra's profits in 2 years' time will be no higher than they were back in 2002. So the company's had no growth in its profits over that time. And that's why the share price today is so much lower than it was 10 years ago, or 12 years ago, in fact, during the internet bubble.
So if you bought in the second tranche, you're still underwater.
Well, the second tranche, you're underwater. The first tranche, you're doing, I think, okay now, just if you include all the dividends that have been paid in that time. And the third tranche, you've done reasonably well. But here's the interesting thing. The intrinsic value, we believe that the intrinsic value of Telstra is significantly lower than the current price. We reckon it's closer to $3 than it is to $5. Now, what does that mean? That doesn't mean we think the share price is going to drop. But what we believe is that the current share price enthusiasm that you're seeing in Telstra at the moment is related to its yield. And the yield is obviously really, really strong compared to wherever else you can invest your money. Now, what happens when interest rates start going up? It won't look so attractive anymore. I don't know when that's going to turn and when sentiment towards the company will turn, but I'm fairly confident at some point in the future it will.
Okay, thank you.
A pleasure.
You heard it here. David, you're wondering about the Reserve Bank and interest rates and how it could impact retail shares.
Yeah, g'day. Look, thanks for taking my call. This is just a question in the sense that the Reserve Bank's always flagged a multi-speed or two-speed economy with effectively the domestic economy in the doldrums and the mining sector.
Holding us together, yeah.
Yeah, and in a sense, to keep inflation under control, they've sort of left interest rates at a level which keeps domestic demand relatively subdued. So with the mining sector coming off the boil, there's a lot of talk that the Joe bloke on the street is going to start to have to pick up the slack, in which case falling interest rates will stoke domestic demand and allow further spending. The way I've seen some retail shares go in the last couple of months, a couple have gone up by 50%. And I suppose with the recent talk about further requirements for interest rate cuts, my sort of thoughts were, my question was, exactly how Roger feels.
Okay.
Retail shares might.
All right. Well, I think if I could be so bold as to suggest the one mistake I think that you're making is that you're looking at the macro economy to make micro decisions. And I think that's a mistake. We don't employ any economists. And what we're more interested in are the numbers for individual businesses. Now, one of the property trusts, one of the real estate investment trusts came out with their numbers yesterday, and it was Colonial. And they own a lot of shopping centres around Australia. And what they do is they look at, or what they publish, are the turnover statistics for the stores in their shopping centres. So who's going well, what stores, and what so apparel stores aren't going very well at the moment, but homewares are doing really well. Discount variety seems to be doing really well. And so we're interested in those kinds of numbers because that tells us which companies are going to be increasing their profits. And what everyone chases in the stock market are increasing profits. Now, we've had periods where interest rates were 18%. We've had periods where interest rates are where they are today. And through all those periods, there are companies that are doing reasonably well. I think it's more important not to try and worry about what's going to happen to interest rates and on a macro level what the consumer is going to do, but to have a look at which businesses are actually making profits. And in the retail sector, it seems to be restaurants and cafes. They're doing very, very well. Homewares is doing very well. I think discount variety is going very well. Companies like the Reject Shop seem to be going quite well. So you need to look more specifically and not worry about pulling the trigger based on, or holding back from pulling the trigger based on what the macro environment, or what economists believe the macro environment is going to do.
It's expected that the Australian economy will grow about 3.5% over the next 12 to 24 months.
Well, that's the prediction. But here's the thing. If you could have an angel sit on the end of your bed, Tony, and tell you precisely what the GDP number would be and precisely where interest rates would be and precisely what the Australian dollar would be, and if they happened to say to you, it'll all be pretty much the same as today, what would you do with that information? How would you go and make money from that? Well, you couldn't really. Mm. What you need to do is you need to look at individual businesses, and you need to look at those businesses that are going well. So in that environment where the economy is only growing at 3%, there are still plenty of businesses that are growing their profits at 20, 30%. For example, some of the internet service providers are growing their profit that quickly. Some of the telcos are growing their profits that quickly. Yeah. Some of the retailers are growing their profits that quickly. The healthcare companies are growing profits at sometimes 20 and 30% per annum. So they're the sorts of things that we're interested in, those businesses that are growing their profits massively. We only want to buy them when they're cheap, so we want to buy them when no one else likes them.
What's the old saying from Rene Rivkin, buy in gloom, sell in boom?
Yeah, exactly. Well, a classic example, Tony, last couple of years ago, there was a company called Cochlear, and everyone knows that company. I think it's one of the great Australian exports. Just an amazing business. And a couple of years ago, they had a global recall of one of their hearing devices, and they saw that a fraction of 1% of the fitted product was failing. Now, it wasn't causing any pain to the patient or anything like that. It wasn't dangerous. It just stopped working. And they recalled. And the analyst community said this is going to massively damage their reputation. And the share price plunged from $66 to about $43 in the space of a couple of months. Now, I don't know about you, but I reckon if I was going to have a product implanted into my brain to help me hear, I would want to know that the company was so on the ball that if a fraction of 1% of those products failed, they were going to demand a global recall to hell with the cost, and they were going to actually make sure the product was fixed. And, of course, that's precisely what happened. The share price went down. We got that opportunity, and away it went.
David, thanks for the question. Harris, you are doing a master's course at the moment, and you're finding Roger's views quite refreshing.
Yes, that's right, Tony. I'm just started my master's this year, and we keep getting told that it's impossible to beat the market, and the market's perfectly efficient. And it's just good to hear someone making a living out of beating the market, and it's a bit refreshing compared to the defeatist mentality of that the academics are telling me the last few months. So it's a pleasure to hear it.
Well, I can tell you those very same academics at Sydney University did some research into a particular quantitative approach that we were looking at, and it significantly outperformed persistently. So I don't know how they can hold on to this idea that the markets are efficient and they can't be beaten. I just think you need to remove the rubbish. Remember, the index that they're using to come up with the argument, the All Ordinaries Index or the ASX 200, they've got some really poor companies in that index, and you just got to remove the poor ones and keep the good ones, and you can't help but do better. Just create your own index.
What about
Harris,
keep speaking. Yep.
Yeah, no, that's what I've been trying to do myself, and it's much more fun than the just trying to go along with the flow of the market to try and find individual companies, as you've been saying. It seems to be much more beneficial, and at least much more interesting from an academic point of view as well.
Well, all the indices are built on companies based on their size, and that's not a reason for investing in them. Just because they're big or small or medium size, that's not a reason you should invest in them. You want to invest in great quality businesses, and I've described how you go about identifying those good quality businesses. So all you need to do is remove the poor quality businesses, and you're left with businesses that are good quality, and that's a new index, and your index should beat the standard indices.
You happy?
It's good. It's a pleasure to hear it. Thank you.
Thanks, Harris. 1-300-800-222 if you'd like to join us. Linda, you want to ask about indexed lifetime annuities as part of a retirement strategy.
Yes, thank you, Tony and Roger. And also, I'd like to know whether they're as secure as an income stream.
Well, look, it depends on the securities that they're investing in. These are a structured security, and so what you need to understand, and I'm not going to talk about any specific ones tonight for fear of actually recommending them, but what you need to understand is precisely what they're investing in to produce that income stream, okay, that indexed income stream. And if you're confident and comfortable that there's no risk in the securities that they're investing in, then there's less risk to the income stream that you're seeking.
Right. They appear to be an insurance product rather than a market product.
Well, that's exactly right. Again, they're investing in a security, though, in the background, and that those insurances or whatever they're investing in have to be securitized in order to produce a stream that's reliable and they can then sell to you. So right. You just need to go back and look at precisely what it is that they're investing in to create that income stream for you and ask yourself whether or not that's reliable.
Okay. Thank you very much, Roger.
It's a pleasure.
Linda, thank you. Grant, you want to know about buying into low-valued shares.
Yes, that's correct. How are you, Roger?
I'm very, very well. What do you mean by low-valued shares? Do you mean 5-cent shares and 1-cent shares, that sort of thing?
That's the
ones. Yeah, okay. All right, there's more of it. Let me tell you this. There's 1,800... 90 companies listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. Now, there are vastly more securities than that listed, but that's how many company ordinary shares are listed. And of those, about 1,200 didn't make any money in the last reporting season. So 1,200, almost 1,200 of the 1,800 made no profit.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, that means that there's a whole bunch that have a very good reason for being at 1 and 2 cents. And what you're describing to me, or what you're alluding to, is a strategy that is really not investing at all, but speculating. What you're doing is you're turning the stock market into a casino, and you're betting on black or red. You're betting on the up and down of a share price rather than betting on great businesses. And what I suggest you do is, rather than bet on the share price, which is gambling, you think about good quality businesses and just try and buy those when the rest of the market thinks that something that has befallen the company, which is temporary, is permanent. And when the market treats something that is temporary as permanent, then you've got a great opportunity.
So I did make a gamble a few years ago. I bought them at 3 cents, and I sold 15,000 at $1.
Yeah, no, well done. And some people go to the casino and they bet on black and they put it all on black and it lands on black and they walk away with a lot more money. But that doesn't mean that most people won't succeed from that strategy. And in fact, that's the case.
Good evening, John. You're wondering where Roger thinks agricultural markets are heading.
Yeah. And is there any bright lights for farmers at the moment, mate? Whether they're producing food, as in protein, or producing grain.
Look, I think here's the thing. I actually believe that the world needs more food, and that at some point in the next decade or two, we're going to face a global food crisis. That's my belief. And that's because we're urbanising so much of the arable land around the world. But the problem is that when you're a farmer, as you well know, is you could get the crop right, you could get the market right, you could get the timing right, and yet your entire crop can be wiped out. You know, and unfortunately, there's not a lot, great deal you can do about that. So it's an incredibly risky thing to do, but we all need it. And we all need it. And because we all need it, we need to support agriculture in Australia. And the problem for farmers in Australia, of course, is that we've got, and this is just my view, of course, but we've got a government that isn't really helping. Of course, this level playing field idea is an absolute nonsense. And the other problem is the government policies have allowed companies like Woolworths and Coles to structure their business in such a way that they can actually generate high returns for themselves at the expense of their suppliers. And unfortunately, farmers are caught in the middle, and there's not a great deal they can do about it at the moment.
So what you're saying, Roger, is we will eternally be price takers and be manipulated by the likes of Coles and Woolworths.
I think until you start acting like the French, and acting together rather than individuals, until you start forming a body that actually says, you know what, we're actually not going to sell all of our product at the lowest possible price to the cheapest buyer. We're actually going to add value to our product, and we're going to demand higher prices for our product. Until you all get together and start working together, and you, as long as you remain fragmented, unfortunately, yes, the answer is yes, you're going to struggle a bit.
Thanks for the call, John. Jackie's rung in from China. Jackie, you've got a defined benefit pension and you're wondering whether it's worth taking it out and moving into shares.
That's right. I have to pay a fair bit of tax if I take it out, but I just wonder if I should maintain the defined benefit.
Well, a defined benefit's a pretty rare beast. You know, not many people get those anymore. So there's some security associated with that. And I'm not the person to actually tell you to jump out of the frying pan and into the fire. You know, I think you can make very good returns in the stock market, but whether now is the right time to do that for you, I really can't help you with that. I'm sorry.
Jackie, are you getting sufficient return from the defined benefit at the moment? Are you happy with the return, or you think it's a little subdued?
Well, I haven't taken it yet, but it will be about 7.5%.
Well, look, there are people out there who would swap with you gladly, and take 7.5%. They'd be absolutely delighted with that kind of return, particularly since government bonds are offering returns that are something like half that or less than half that.
Okay, thank you. And for the long term, though.
Yeah, look, the long term, you're going to need to have some exposure, I think, to businesses, and the stock market is the way to do that. But of course, you know, it's important not to just buy any stock, particularly the blue chips at high prices. You need to be very careful about how you go about investing in the stock market, and that will mean finding a fund manager that actually can do that for you.
Okay, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Jackie, you're calling in from China.
What a great place to be at the moment. Busy place.
It's definitely a booming. Roger, thanks so much for being there tonight.
Delighted to be
here.
We've
had an SMS saying, can you give us a couple to look out for, Roger?
Yeah, look, I think Cochlear at the moment is an interesting one. The share price has dropped considerably, and it's done that simply because there's fears about a new Asian rival. We've looked into that Asian rival. We don't think there's much rivalry there at all. Mm-hmm. So these sorts of things happen from time to time, and I think that's a great business. And if the Aussie dollar does eventually fall, then Cochlear is making a lot of its profits overseas. That will translate to high profits in Australia.
Roger Montgomery from Montgomery Fund with us tonight.